Well, hello, and I'm delighted today to welcome someone that I'm really inspired by, and I'd like to welcome Jane.
Hello.
Hello. We've got Jane Montague with us today, and just a little bit of background of how I know Jane. When I moved house, which was a big part of my recovery plan, I moved down to be near the sea. I was seeking to start some yoga because I knew that that's exactly what my body needed. And I was very, very fortunate to come across Jane and Jane's classes. And Jane is just a really inspirational yoga teacher, among many other things which she's going to tell us about today. And a lot of the principles and different techniques that Jane has taught me has been absolutely paramount to helping me maintain my well-being now I've recovered. So thank you, firstly, Jane, for all the lovely work you've done with me on a personal level. But what I'd like to do now is obviously let our people that are listening today have the benefit of all your wisdom. So could you just tell us, Jane, I'm sort of fascinated by the portfolio career that you have and how you juggle being a single mum of two and you make it look seamless. Can you tell our listeners about your life and your career?
Gosh, where to start? Well, I suppose starting from the present and moving backwards, I met you in yoga, which I've practiced or taught for at least 20 years. But my mother started me off when I was about 14. So that's how I started my yoga. So it's been an important part of my life, and it's helped me in everything I do, work-wise or in my personal life. So I suppose, yes, as I was saying, my mother started me at 14 with yoga. But I actually elected when I left school to go and train as a nurse. And that was a very important part of my life experience. Because I had to deal with illness, other people's illness, and actually death as well. So I also went through a period of adjustment when I left home because my home life wasn't terribly good when I left. And I did a lot of soul searching then, and I used yoga and reading. Reading a lot around about how people got through problems, self-help books and stuff like that, which sort of naturally led to more investigation on sort of spiritual matters, which came together again in yoga. So I went to university eventually, and I picked up my yoga classes again, by which time I was training to be an architect. So I spent 7 years training to be an architect, and then was unleashed into the world. And probably at that stage put yoga on the back burner and relied on a continuing interest in what my life meant to me and what life was, whether life was a financial journey or a spiritual journey. And I suppose I've always been aware of the fact that it was more than just making money, buying things, material things. So, yes, I qualified as an architect. I worked probably about 10 years, by which time I really wanted to have children. And I was fortunate enough to become pregnant with my daughter. And then I married. So it's a long way around, but... And I had my son. So then I had the added challenge of bringing up children. And like a lot of us, I went through that life experience of divorce and stuff like that, and I was then left with bringing children up by myself. And I decided to use yoga to fit around my lifestyle, because in architecture one has to work very long hours, usually up in London. And wear a black roll neck jumper, and it's preferable if you're a bloke, actually. But so I found that at age, 38, 40, that I wasn't in such demand. So yoga was very good for that. So I started teaching more classes. And also trained at the same time as a homeopath, because the whole issue of energy and how one balances one's energy and lives life to the full without overstretching yourself was becoming of more interest to me because I had less of it. And I found that homeopathy was really good for keeping me on a sort of even keel.
That was news to me because I didn't even know.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So
I'm not at all surprised.
Yes. And you know, I suppose similarly, I trained as a masseuse as well because again, I was interested in how one juggled or kept your energy at a sort of healthy level. And I think it's particularly important when you're a woman and a mother, because. Well, even if you're not a mother, you've got energy moving out. You're invariably a confidant to friends. You're supporting maybe your parents, your maybe your children. And women are very good at looking after other people, but not themselves. So,
I agree.
You know, and I think what happens is that initially you can handle it. But it's like that old adage of stress being like holding a cup of tea. You know, if you hold a cup of tea for 10 minutes, it's no big deal. If you hold a cup of tea for an hour, it becomes more of an issue. If you try and hold the same cup of tea for a day, yeah. It's painful. And stress and lack of energy, which is sort of linked, it's like that, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, if you're holding a cup of tea for a day, then you've got problems. And I think if you don't deal with how you manage your energy after several years, it comes back and gets you.
It does. It's a bigger bite you.
It bites you in the bottom.
It does.
So this is what happened with me. And I really had to use yoga to maintain that energy level. So it's sort of discipline really for me.
Yeah, so it's something that's part of your everyday.
Yes.
And it comes across because I know you do a lot, but you are always, you always seem so that you've got time for people, that you're balanced. Mm. And I think, you know, you're definitely someone that would be a wonderful role model. And we talk in on our programme about finding a role model, someone that, you know, is getting it right so that we can emulate them, because it's important. Certainly when you've not sort of functioned that way yourself. So that's great. Thank you for that. So you've mentioned your mother introduced you to yoga.
Yes.
So at what point were you inspired to train?
Well, I suppose when my mother was practicing, it wasn't particularly fashionable. And there was a chap called Richard Hickelman on the TV who would do a sort of day class, and my mother would follow that. And she'd buy all these strange books, you know, with people in old positions. And then she'd try to emulate them at home with small children, cats and dogs, you know, weaving their way around her. But she was quite committed to staying healthy, I suppose, and it made sense to her. And I used to watch her, and I really think that people learn by example, not by what they're told.
It's almost an imprint, isn't it?
It is.
My example was the opposite. You know, my mother, and still is at 81, very, very, always on the go, very, very busy, always working.
Mm.
And so that was my example. So wonderful that you have such a great example to follow, and she's passed on a wonderful legacy. So
yes,
I think
she has.
Key that if we're parents, we have to be very aware, don't we, of the legacy.
I really think so. I think you're right, because I trained as an architect. My father was an architect, so that's what his legacy was for me, I suppose, in terms of working as an architect, which I love. But equally of equal importance is my work with yoga, and that was from my mother. So it's an example of how children do watch their parents and they replicate what their parents do or how their parents behave. So, you know, you're setting your children up for a fall if you don't actually look after yourself. You're teaching them to ignore intuition and, you know, their own feelings about how they manage their own energy, really.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we were talking earlier, off of the recording, about teenagers, you know, and teenagers do go through this time, don't they, where they have no trouble resting at all, do they? They don't drive themselves so hard. You know, and I wonder as well sometimes about, you know, when I think back to how I spoke to my teenagers about that time of their life, whether I, you know, I wasn't very complimentary about the fact that they wanted to lay around. And, you know, because my measure of appropriate behaviour was being busy.
Yeah, mine was the same, really. I had a father who used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning every day, and because that's what he was used to.
Yes.
And it's, I don't know, it's, what do they refer it? Refer to it as a Calvinist or some sort of expression, religious expression where...
it's Protestant work ethic.
Yeah, Protestant work ethic, that's what it was. And one was justified by the things you did rather than what you were.
Yes.
And whilst I think there's a balance there somewhere, I do think now that we can learn. We can learn every day by just checking in on why we feel that people should be behaving in a certain way and what it means to us.
It's our own value system.
It's our own value system. Yeah,
we do cover that in depth on one of the sessions, I think, which is coming up in a few weeks' time. So. Yeah, very interesting. I've talked to you all day, Jess. So what is your philosophy for health and well-being?
For health and well-being? Well, I suppose the bottom line for me is that I believe that we're all here for a purpose. So that's my datum from where I start. I believe that one has to look after one's physical body because it's the house for one's spirit or whatever you want to call it. You know, we're not just a gross physical body. I actually believe that we're more than that and that we owe it to ourselves, you know, to look after our physical bodies. And this is somebody who has spent many enjoyable evenings in pubs and, you know, and really burnt the candle at both ends when I was younger. But I really feel that you put rubbish in, you get rubbish out. And I like cream cakes and the odd glass of wine like everybody else, but I really think that one has to eat a good standard of food on a fairly regular basis. And maybe as one gets older, be a bit more moderate about one's habits, you know. So that's my physical body, and well-being is really an ongoing sort of journey about investigating what it means to be alive and why I'm here. Mm-hmm. I really think purpose releases huge amounts of energy.
It does. And when you're off purpose, it drains and takes your energy away completely, doesn't
it? Yes, and I think that in the past I've certainly made the mistake of having too big a purpose. And thinking in terms of a purpose in life as being a single aim, whereas we have purposes at a daily level. And it could be your purpose today is to wash your hair or do the shopping, but if you set yourself more modest objectives, you can build on them and it builds up your feeling of well-being.
And
you can extend that gently, and that's what I try to remember when I feel tired or rushed or anxious. So that's what I use as a sort of way of knowing if I'm on course. The other thing I use is if I feel stressed, I recognise it as a resistance in myself to the reality of that particular day. So stress for me is always saying no internally to something. So I think the first thing I do is try to accept what's going on and work from there.
Yes, that's absolutely key when you feel it, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's quite scary, the idea of accepting where you are, but I don't think you can move forward without actually being mentally where you are physically.
And also having some appreciation that maybe being where you are is where you need to be right now.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know you help so many people through your yoga and meditation techniques. In fact, you choose to work closely with people who are suffering with health problems. Mm. I know that you work, for instance, with an MS group as well, a multiple sclerosis group. Was that a conscious choice, Jane?
Yes, it was, because yoga's done such a lot for me. And I thought, I was aware of the fact that historically, particularly when I was younger, people who turned up at yoga classes were swathed in lycra and had loads of makeup on and looked beautiful. And it was more of a bit like a sort of promenade where they were sort of showing off their bodies, and rather than an earnest inquiry into the mind-body link and stuff like that. And there were other people who really would like to investigate yoga as a sort of unity between mind and body, but couldn't access the classes, couldn't stand up to do the postures. So I was interested in developing a way of working with people who were in wheelchairs, for example. So yes, it was a deliberate choice, really, and it's taught me a huge amount. And it's been very good for the people I've worked with as well.
Well, I know Heather, who comes into our class. She, you've extended her interest because she got the extra classes that you do as well with completely able-bodied people. So, it's great work that you're doing. Your classes, I can't wax lyrical enough about them. They are special. They're a wonderful combination of yoga movements, visualisation and meditation. What do you find helps most and why?
Mm. Well, that's a how long is a piece of string type question, because everybody is so individual. And I think people are quite patient in group classes because they have to accept a sort of generalised approach. Whereas really, some people are more visual-based, you know, they find visualisation more potent. Other people really want to feel the physical sort of work in their bodies, yet others want to be really still. And people come for different reasons. You know, some people come because they feel very stressed. Other people come because they're depressed and feel isolated. Often isolation is a sort of key word there. I think it is for all sorts of illness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I really think that the physical body informs the mind. And so once people realise that if they work with their body and maybe put their bodies in positions that they wouldn't normally, without pain, I have to add, they access different states of being and they discover different parts of themselves, which is a huge joy for them, really. So I think, yes, it works for different people in different ways, but also the group dynamic is so lovely because there's nothing more powerful than a group of people holding the silence in the room.
Yes.
If you're not used to it, it's quite a difficult thing to get your head around initially, and people feel quite twitchy. But once you accept it and you share silence with people, it's very, very powerful. It sort of reinforces that sense of unity that we all have, really. I think when we're well, we feel united, unified with other people, don't we? We feel sister.
Yeah.
We feel that sort of kindred spirit. And when we're ill, I can only speak personally, you feel isolated. You feel cut off from the source, don't you?
You do.
So I think group classes have benefits that way.
Yeah. Definitely. So in terms of many of our listeners will be struggling with either ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, and people with a lot of pain, with fibromyalgia. Mm. What kind of experience have you had working with those kinds of clients?
Well, I suppose I trained with Angela Stevens about probably 20 years ago. She's a fantastic teacher who specialises in ME. She lives in Woodhurst in Kent, so if you haven't met her, you must go and see her.
She sounds like somebody.
She's a lovely woman
speak to.
Who oozes what she teaches, really.
Yeah.
And Angela, I think she had spina bifida, or she has spina bifida, or some sort of chronic spinal problem, which she's worked with all her life. You'd never know if you saw her. But she inspired me. And she was the first person to make me aware of the specific issues of ME and the fact that it's a physical limitation as well as a psychological one as well, and how they are both linked. So now remind me of the question, because I'm having a senior moment.
That's all right, just really about kind of the experience that you've had with working, particularly with people that have come to classes.
Well, I suppose in the MS group, we also have people who suffer from ME. And it's a bit like a snowball, isn't it? If you have ME and you haven't been able to use your body, just your physical body, for a while, then it starts to close down. The muscles start to atrophy. You can get pain that you didn't have before. You get sort of postural problems, one-sided weaknesses, and then you get the concomitant mental sort of upset disease. You know, people are very upset about what's happening to their bodies, and so I've worked with that sort of thing. People get very angry as well. I've often witnessed people get very angry. They're frustrated, understandably. So I don't think you can work just with a physical body. One has to work with how people view their current state of being.
Yes. So you want to explain to me the impact the body has on the mind.
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yes, well, I suppose it's, as I was sort of saying before, it's really about how, for example, if you're in ME, if you aren't capable of walking around very much, you have the physical restriction, but also the mental restriction. So the corollary of that is, if you can move your body a bit better, it does change your mind. And one of the sort of common factors when one's ill is that the body sort of closes down. It becomes more of a sort of protected shell. You know, you can almost see people contracting into sort of fetal type shape sometimes in very bad cases. So working on opening the body up and extending the energy out, bigger energy around the body, really changes one's mindset. You know, and if you haven't experienced this, then, you know, maybe lie down and stretch the arms out and the legs out like a star and notice the difference between lying in that position and lying with your arms along your body and your feet together.
There's a movement that we do in yoga, and I probably won't remember the name of it, but it's one way you recommend when your head is feeling really overwhelmed and you feel like all your energy is up in your head, and you do this wonderful movement where you enable us to move our energy down into our feet.
Yes.
And that was so dramatic for me when you taught me that. So I can remember having this really whirring mind, and as you say, when you can't move your body, your mind is probably still racing, and we get into this anxiety loop ME. And so that's a fantastic exercise.
You'll have to remind me, because there's quite a few things you can do.
Something like Tibetan.
Oh, yes. I thought it might be that one.
Yes,
it's wonderful. It sort of assumes that one is okay standing up. But if you can stand up, it's really about taking the energy, as you say, down to your feet and grounding yourself. And before I describe it, it's worth remembering that it's quite a good exercise in the summer to take your shoes off and have your feet on the earth. And you often find that children who are bundles of energy, aren't they? The first thing they do, they come into the house, is they take their shoes off. And it's almost like, you know, it's like an electrical build-up in the body that you have to discharge through the earth. But the Tibetan healing exercise is to make you feel more grounded on your feet. And what it involves is standing upright with maybe your feet hip distance apart. You cross your arms over your chest, so you have one hand on each shoulder. So you're standing a bit like you would imagine. Well, it's not quite like on the top of those tins, but your hands are crossed, so your right hand's on your left shoulder and vice versa. And then you cross your feet. So you cross your feet and your toes are one on top of the other. If you can, if not, you just cross your legs. And then you shut your eyes and you try to fold forward. So you hinge from the hips so you can keep the legs bent. And you try and bring your head down to your shins. But very, 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 very slowly. So we're talking over a period of 2-3 minutes. And it's very, very strong. So if you want to make it less strong, you do it faster. But with your eyes shut, of course, you have to balance. And your feet become glued to the floor. So you move down very, very slowly. And then, if you can, you move up just as slowly to that upright position again. And then, finally, you take the elbows up to the sky. And this is all with your eyes shut, if you can do it with your eyes shut. And then you come back to that start position. And if you're able to, you recross your arms so the other arm is on top and the other leg is on top. And you repeat the exercise. So all in all, it would probably take about 10 minutes. I mean, you can be much quicker if you want to, but 10 minutes would be good. And you'll find that your feet will completely glue to the floor. And for me, I've lost that chatter in the mind. It's fantastic.
The head completely clears.
Yes.
And you can feel energy.
Yes.
Physically, you're aware of it.
Yes.
Moving in your body.
Yes.
And it's grounded to your feet.
Yes.
And it's just so powerful.
Yes.
So I'm so glad. Thank you for sharing that one with us. And we will video you one day.
Oh, yes. Okay.
We'd love to be able to show people
some of those
movies. Many people suffer from muscle pain and have been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which stops them moving.
Mm.
What are your thoughts on pain and what advice can you give?
Yes. Well, I think pain is there for a reason. And I wouldn't advise people to push through pain, but I think that maybe attempting to move a little further every day, even if it's a millimetre, is good. I'd work within one's comfort zone, sort of stretching yourself a little, if you're doing yoga, for example, but not going for the burn or anything like that.
Something you taught me was letting go of striving.
Yeah.
Because competitive people, when they're starting in yoga, especially in a group work, you might find yourself with one eye watching what the other's doing, and you taught me not to do that.
Yeah.
So I think it is this whole thing, that it's your journey in yoga, isn't it?
Absolutely. But the thing is, I think that everybody's the same as us, you know, initially. And there are days when you want to check other people. I mean, we're only human, aren't we? But I think that if you are aware of feeling stressed about things like that, it's really good to shut your eyes so there's no visual focus and to stay where you are. So you start where you are, not where you want to be, and you move a little bit. And the irony is that if you let go of ambition, your body will relax down into posture more. It takes longer, but yoga is a process. So it's the journey, a bit like life. It's not about getting to death immediately. It's about journeying through things and picking up information on route. So I think I'm the same as anybody else. You know, you have ambitious days, but really it's much better to...
And I think that's key. When you just reminded me there, is that you always set an intention whenever we do yoga. So that setting an intention, how could you...
balance, yeah.
Yeah, sort of explain to people why that's important for their day or their...
I suppose it's quite interesting when you're talking about letting go at the same time. It's a balance, isn't it? And I think actually humour is fantastic as a buffer. Because, yes, everybody needs to set an intention to release energy, I think. But one needs to know that you can change your mind, you can adapt your journey on a daily basis or through a posture, depending on how you feel on that day. And humour is quite good at putting perspective on one's life, because I think a lot of stress for me, for example, in the past has been looking at other people's postures or looking at other people's lives and then looking, comparing my own posture or my own life. We all do it, don't we?
Yes.
And it's a terrible duality, because there's always going to be people who can do postures better or do their lives better. And it takes quite a lot of discipline and work to give that up without throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yes.
So you set yourself your own agenda, which can change all the time. And then you enjoy the journey. That's how I approach it anyway.
Thank you. I know, different intentions I've set in classes have been to appreciate where I'm at this stage, or to fill my body with energy today, or, you know, whatever it is, it just helps your body to know what you're aiming for without striving.
Yes.
I think that's what I've learned.
Yes.
So, where are we? The people that we have recovering from ME in our community, they're all at very different levels, as you know, in your classes. If someone were bedbound, Jane, how could they start incorporating movement?
Yes, but I suppose it's personal, isn't it? Because you'd have to know what the physical restrictions were and also psychological restrictions. But I suppose you could work from the periphery inwards, if that was okay. For example, the fingertips and the toes are where all the meridians end in acupressure and acupuncture terms, so they're very important. And by bringing the thumb to the individual fingers, first, second, third, fourth, you're accessing different parts of your brain, which research has logged. So with every different finger, a different part of your brain will light up on one of these scans. So it's just being happy with starting with something you can do. Start with your fingertips, maybe using a word, maybe investigating the meaning of the fingers. I mean, I always find it very interesting to know what, at an esoteric level, historical, what they connect different fingers with. So then, or you can say that finger represents something and give your fingers meaning. You're taking your head with you then, aren't you?
Yeah.
Fingers, and then flexing the fingers and the hand, you know, articulating the knuckles, wrists, you know, that sort of thing. And similarly with the toes, stretching through the toes. I mean, how many times do the toes get space to wriggle? You know, most of us have been crammed in shoes every day. Just toes, working onto the balls of the feet, taking the weight onto one ball of the foot and then the other. You know, and if you're lying down, sort of thinking about walking, you can visualise walking at the MS Society. A lot of my friends there can't walk. But just the action of thinking about walking is lighting up different parts of their brain. If they can actually pull their toes towards them, then they're using the muscles in their legs. So it's really about being quite intelligent, you know. Eye exercises, very important, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah.
So you can imagine your face like a clock, and you can move round the hours, 1 through to 12, and then the other way. You can take your index finger and take it from the bridge of your nose out to the end of your arm and in again, just for focusing.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes, neck, head, all sorts of things like that. And I think wriggling is fantastic. I think wriggling is very, very good, because you're making more space in your body. And actually, there's something quite fun about wriggling. It has an impact on your mind, I think, you know.
What top tips would you like to share with those people who are scared of exercise in case they relapse?
Yes, well, I suppose to realise that there's all sorts of different ways of exercising, and that maybe they shouldn't repeat the sort of exercise that they did before, but discover other ways of exercising. And also to reflect on what exercise means for them, whether there's an obstacle, a mental obstacle, that they need to think about. I use writing. I find that, you know, if there's a mental obstacle, you can't quite work out what it is, you can, if you can write, or you could dictate, or in some way record what's on your mind. So, I mean, sort of looking out the window, what you're thinking about immediately, and you find these repetitive themes coming out all the time. Because often physical restriction is a reflection of your mental obstacles. It's all mind, you know. So if you can work with those, just use it as a journey to explore yourself, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because one of the exercises that we encourage all the way through is Morning Pages from the Artist's Way.
Morning Pages, this is the book I use.
Yes,
Morning Pages, fantastic. It just wonderful.
Has an amazing impact on
isn't
the life.
It?
So thanks,
yeah.
that's the endorsement of something that we...
That's the one I use,
It's excellent. When people are struggling with the anxiety of their situation or trying to cope with perhaps insomnia, it has such a detrimental effect on the body being able to enter a healing state. What could you recommend?
Yes, insomnia is a very challenging thing, isn't it? Well, the Tao Te Ching would say go with the flow, and if you can't sleep, and you're able to get up, that's what I'd say. And there's all sorts of different sort of ways of being with it. Some people say what you do is you go to your back door, particularly if it's winter, you open the door and you become very cold, and then you go back to bed and the bed feels very nice and warm and cosy, and that can induce sleep. Personally, I find for insomnia, radio and tapes. I use, not tapes nowadays, it's CDs, but I use CDs of things that I find interesting. I have lots of different sort of new age CDs, I suppose, investigating how we think and how we view our lives. You know, Eckhart Tolle, have you heard of him?
The Power of Now. Power of Now.
I love... I love the work of Michael Neal, Lynn McTaggart, The Zero Point Field. Just reflecting on myself in my life, I suppose. And trying to let go of my expectations, because it's the expectations and the reality and the gap between them that causes so much stress, isn't it? And stress is fear, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's really reflecting on what you're scared of and stuff like that.
We talk a lot in our programme about stress triggers, and I know we've spoken earlier that a big interest for you around ME was that you felt you could have perhaps just almost tipped over into that at a very stressful period in your life. So have you identified those stress triggers and for you, and what are they?
Yes, I think it's about... not living up to an image of what I think I should be at any one time in my life. What sort of mother I should be, what sort of architect I should be, what sort of yoga teacher I should be, where I should be living, how I've used my life. You know, you can go on and on and on. I'm sure people recognise these sort of familiar themes. And if you have an expectation of yourself which you're not living up to in as quick a way as you'd like to, it causes terrible stress, deep, chronic sort of stress, which is like a chronic trigger, isn't it, for discontent with yourself. And if you're discontented with yourself, how on earth can you be happy with anybody else, you know? How can people be happy with you? Because I think that, you know, people react at a very energetic level, don't they?
They do, yes. We've all had that sense where we've walked into a room and we've immediately picked up if someone's spoken what's going on for them.
Yes.
Or if there's a bad atmosphere. Or, or being around somebody that is just so in the right place and in the right skin. And it's, you find that you feel great too very quickly, don't you? So there's this exchange of energy.
Yes, it's about justifying yourself. And if you do come from that Protestant work ethic background, you know, it's very interesting to reflect on how you feel you must justify your existence in terms of what you achieve. And people have different expectations, but there's always, if you're stressed, it's usually because you feel you should be doing something or
something. Sure, it was you that use the expression that we are human beings, not human doings.
Yes.
And that really stuck out for me. And, you know, I'd always defined myself by what I did.
Yes.
And now I don't. It's about being and being in my own skin and enjoying each other.
And
moment.
I think that one of the biggest lessons I've learned, I've probably said to you before, is when I thought I should be meditating, and I didn't find the time to meditate, because meditation is so wonderful. And my teacher said to me, try 1 minute in every hour to start.
That's great advice.
And I think people, those of us who dally with, you know, chronic fatigue or ME or illness in general, are usually very hard taskmasters on ourselves, let alone other people. And some of us find it very difficult initially to sit down for 1 minute and do nothing. One minute, shut your eyes and try not to think about the fact that you need to load the dishwasher or whatever. You know, just let go for 1 minute. And if you find that's okay for a couple of weeks, then maybe build up to 2 minutes. And before you know it, you'll be sitting for, just sitting and being for 5 minutes. And that's so refreshing and
clears your head,
clears your body.
Yes. And I honestly was one of those people that never thought I could clear that from my mind. Now I can sit and I can actually have complete space in my mind, and all I can see is colours.
Yes.
And it's how you feel afterwards.
Absolutely.
As well. You take it into your day, don't you?
Yes, you do.
So I think I know that you will have inspired so many people just to try
at
least 1 minute. Because, you know, the hard taskmasters are the people that get ME.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it seems like the worst thing in the world, because then you physically can't do the things your mind is desperate for you to do.
It's like Mahatma Gandhi apparently said that on days when he had extra work to do, he would meditate for twice as long, because he had to make space in his mind to deal with the extra challenges. And I really think that's ever so true. I mean, I'm struggling like everybody else with that, you know, notion of meditating for twice as long if I have lack of time, but I really think it does work.
Because the time when you start on your task, you're in a completely different space.
Yeah. To you have to still chuck your water on top of the pond and wait for it to sort of calm down so you can reach that deeper, still water that is your mind. It's always there, which we find in yoga.
That's exactly, you know, there's days when I think I don't think I can go to yoga today, and it's exactly the time when I make myself go. And it's always that feeling is that I'm so glad I did, because you just come out feeling completely refreshed and renewed. And that you don't have to go to do that. You can do that anywhere, can't you? So that's the wonderful thing. Well, thank you, Jane, for sharing so much of your wisdom. I know how many lives you're going to touch just from this interview today. We'll put details of your classes and your contacts and things on our website, because I know that there are many people that are going to want to know more, and local people that will probably be wanting to come and practice with
you. Well, I look forward to meeting them or talking to them anyway.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Jane.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.